You're up.
Welcome. I'm Connie Foster, Head of Library Technical Services, and we appreciate your coming to Black History Month at your library. It's a partnership project on behalf of the libraries, the WKU Bookstore, Bowling Green Public Library, and the Kentucky Foundation for Women. And we celebrate an event which you may or may not know a little bit of the history of, Black History Month. It was first observed in 1926, and it still remains after all these years under the sponsorship of the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, which was founded by Dr. Carter Woodson, who grew up a son of former slaves in Virginia. Interestingly, Dr. Woodson entered high school at the age of 20, graduated in 2 years, and then went on to get a PhD from Harvard. He chose the second week in February for the celebration because it was the week of birthdays for two men who greatly influenced African Americans, Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. And then in 1976, Black History Week became Black History Month, and it's still under the auspices of the association, which founded it in 1926. And in doing some research, I actually looked in a real encyclopedia because I couldn't find much online, and they said that there is a theme every year for Black History Month, and it's from slavery to freedom, Africans in the Americas. So we try to choose a Kentucky writer or author every year to help us celebrate this event. And we're so fortunate today to have Sheila Williams. I believe she was our first speaker for this event on the South Campus a few years ago, according to my notes. And now she is a much more acclaimed author. Her first novel was Dancing on the Edge of the Roof in 2002. And this culminated literally a lifetime of her writing through elementary, high school, and college. And she notes that she had enough rejection slips before the novel was published to paper two bathrooms and the west wall of her kitchen. So there is hope for all of you who are interested in writing and who want to pursue a career as such. Her most recent novel, Girls Most Likely, the one which you will probably focus on today, has been acclaimed by People Magazine as cheerfully addictive, and Publishers Weekly, I don't know if you knew that, Publishers Weekly says that she offers a sustained portrayal of female friendships with its own loyalties and betrayals. And equally addictive, I found in reading some more of her novels, I have been The Shade of My Own Tree, which focuses on domestic violence and on the right side of the dream. She's originally from Columbus, Ohio. She went to Ohio Wesleyan, and we do forgive her from graduating from the University of Louisville, red of a different kind, but we're glad she's still in the state. She resides in northern Kentucky with her husband, Bruce, and two dogs, Cisco and Poncho. Her books will be for sale afterwards for $12, and she will be available to sign them. We look forward to hearing from Sheila Williams, not only in her own voice, but perhaps through her fiction voice. Welcome, Sheila Williams.
Thank you, Connie. Can you all hear me? Can you hear me now? Is this better without the mic or with the mic?
They're broadcasting.
Are they? Okay. Okay, got it. Thank you very much for coming. How many of you are here because you have to be here? You can be honest. Okay. How many think they're going to stay awake? Okay, good. What a relief. All right, good. I'll try to make this enjoyable for you and maybe just give you a little tidbit to take with you that you might be able to use. How many of you would consider yourselves writers? No one? How many of you have sent an email? How many of you have done text messaging? Okay, then you're all writers. Writing doesn't have to be a novel. It doesn't have to be a formal research paper. Every time you use the language, every time you use a written word, you're a writer. And nowadays, thanks to technology, writing has become more accessible to everyone. You text message, you get creative with the language, because nobody spells out the whole word when you text message, right? There's no time for that. There's no room for that. So you abbreviate, and you're being creative with the language. So I urge you, when you're text messaging, to think about the fact that you, what you're really doing is writing. It's creative writing, because you're taking a word and you're mushing it together and changing it and perhaps spelling it phonetically and sending it to someone else. You're communicating. All writing begins with one thing, and that's the word. I'm a person who is definitely involved in storytelling, and stories, of course, are made up of words as well. When I was growing up, of course, we didn't have, you know, I grew up BC, so this is before cable, this is before cell phones, this is before computers. Stories were told pretty much over the radio, they were told on black and white TV, and they were told around dinner tables. So when I grew up and was very young, there were three generations of my family still living, my great-grandparents, my grandparents, and my parents. And when the family got together, if I behaved myself and didn't, you know, take my peas and put them in my napkin and hide it under my seat or something like that, I was able to stay up with the adults and listen to the stories that they told. And of course, storytelling hasn't changed in the decades following that event. We tell stories about what so-and-so did, what so-and-so said, who did what to whom, why they did it, what we think is going to happen, and how we think it will affect us, whether it will entertain us, educate us, inspire us, or provoke us and make us angry. And the same thing happened back then. My grandparents were great storytellers, and they told stories about what was going on in the country at that time. They told the story of what the neighbor was doing across the street, or what they thought the neighbor was doing across the street. And they told the stories of what had happened in their own families in the decades before. From stories, I graduated into reading, which was also very important to me. Our family always had books around. We were surrounded by magazines and newspapers. I decided that when I was very small, I would start to write as well. And we didn't have cell phones, so I couldn't do text messaging. But what I could do was draw pictures. And then as I got older, I could put words with the pictures. And that's what I did. I continued that process when I went to middle school. How many of you write poetry? Nobody in here writes poetry. I wrote poetry in high school and poetry in college. And then, of course, when you get to college, you have the dreaded research paper. And I know you do those, right? And that was a form of writing, which really drove a lot of my classmates crazy. But I was the one person who could do research papers. So I did a lot of research papers. And what that led me to was books. And, of course, in college, you read the books that you have to read because you have to finish the class and you have to take the test or you have to write the paper. But one of the things I always looked forward to was being able to read the books that I wanted to read and take the adventures that those books would take me on. When I think about that, I think about books that I'm reading now and the places that they are taking me that I probably can't go. Some of them I can't go to because those times and places are gone forever, like Imperial Russia. I'm reading a book now about that's set in Germany just before the Second World War, and it's talking about the rise of Hitler in Germany, and the story is set in Berlin, and it's very interesting to read about what's going on. And of course, that's a time that's passed, but some of the lessons that it may be telling are relevant today. I've read stories and books that are set in Nigeria 40 years ago. You read stories that are considered science fiction or fantasy that take you to a place that's completely in the future, maybe that's set in the year 2500, where instead of driving cars, we all each have a personal module attached to our body that allows us to fly around, or we use spaceships. Words and stories and books can take us on journeys to places that we can't even imagine. And they also teach us lessons along the way. Now, I realize that I'm here as part of Black History Month. And I hadn't really thought about that until I was listening to Connie talk and was trying to remember some of the things that are important about words and history, which is another one of my passions. There's a quote that I often use in some of my talks, and it was done by an actress named Evelyn Nesbitt, and she says, "Nobody can live in the past or the future without being something of a nut." She was an actress, and of course what she was talking about was that her job was to portray characters who might be from the past or might be from the future, and that she felt that made her a little flaky. But I also apply it into our way of looking at history. You have to live in the present, obviously, because if you don't pay attention to where you're going, you'll run into a wall or trip over something. So you can't constantly think about what's going on in the went on in the past or what's about to happen in the future. But those things are important, and sometimes you have to keep the lessons of the past in your mind while you look forward and apply them to what's going on in the future. When I think about that, I think about the fact that I am now writing books, that I have books that actually have my name on it. The relevance and the poignancy of this strikes me when I think about another project that I'm working on, which is genealogy. And I have discovered the names of my great-great-grandparents, whose names were Caroline and Reuben Williams. And they worked on a farm in South Central Virginia. And I recognize that when they were working on the farm in the 1850s, it was illegal for them to learn to read or write. If they were caught reading, they could be killed, or their family members could be hurt, or something awful could happen to them. I mean, it sounds so far away from us, and it sounds like it's not relevant to what we are now, but it's very relevant, because I recognize that they would never have imagined that they would have a great-great-granddaughter who not only reads and writes, but has books with her name on them. That was something that would have been beyond what they would have thought of. I think again of another great-great-grandfather, Frank Montgomery, who was born in 1859 in Central Georgia. And, Jack Montgomery. And Grandpa Jack was about 6 years old when Sherman came through Georgia. And the story that he told, and I did not know him, but from what my mother said, he told them a story of standing on a hill with his mother, holding his hand, watching as the troops came through, as the Union troops came through. And of course, if you know about that part of Civil War history, the troops did a pretty good job of devastating that area. And he stood there and watched that, and that was his contribution to the story of our family, and also a little snippet of the Civil War. But of course, I realized that Jack, whose mother was the housekeeper and the cook and also worked on the farm, also was not allowed to learn to read and write. It was against the law. But when the freedom came, which is how they described it, that was one of the first things that his mother wanted him to do. She sent him to school. And subsequently, he got enough money by selling ice and making oyster stew. And he even made a kind of homemade ice cream, and he would sell it on the street corners. I don't know how he kept all that stuff cold, because this is Georgia, and Georgia gets very hot. But he did, and he earned enough money to open a little store and a restaurant. And he always kept his own books, because reading, writing, figuring, as he would refer to it, was very important to him, and that's what he did. So I think about that legacy, because those people, Frank, Caroline, Reuben, Dick Swanson, Julia, all of those people in a way are standing behind me, and or maybe I'm standing on their shoulders, I'm not sure, but they are around me because without them and the things that they could not do but persevered in so that I could do them is the reason that I'm standing in front of you today. That lesson can also be applied in terms of the past as far as women are concerned. You know, there were times in many societies where women were discouraged from education. You did not send your girls to school. In fact, in many societies, at many levels, you didn't send your boys to school either. It was important for people to be working on the farm, working in the factory, working in the mines, wherever. So at the age of 8 or at the age of 10, the child was taken out of school and sent to work, sent to the farm. In some countries, of course, as you know, in this world, that is still the case. And so we need to be very aware of how fortunate we are to be able to do some of the things that we do. The things that we take for granted, sending a text message, is perhaps something that a woman in a burqa in Afghanistan might not be able to do for a variety of reasons. And I am very aware of that sometimes when I read and I write, when I sit down at the computer, because I have to acknowledge that those things would not have been possible without the strength of the people who went before me, and without now the technology of the future. On the flip side of the coin, you have to live in the future or look towards the future. My agent tells me sometimes that he thinks books are going to be obsolete in about 20 years because people aren't reading books as much as they used to. And for most writers, that's a real chilling prospect. But I'm willing to take on the challenge because I don't think we're going to give up books. I think we will evolve, and we're already doing that. Storytelling will never go out of style. Maybe it'll take place on a cell phone and you'll dial a number and listen to a story or hear a synopsis of something that you're interested in. Maybe it will come over your cell phone or your BlackBerry as a text message. Maybe it's something that'll crawl across the bottom of your computer screen. I'm not willing to give up on literature and on books and on storytelling just because technology is moving at a pace where the physical book may not be around anymore. I think you have to continue to look forward and then adapt. And because of that, I'm looking forward as well into ways that I can continue to tell my stories, whether they are books that you all read, or articles that I've written that you read, or whether they're screenplays. I think a lot of folks don't realize, or they don't think about it, because we don't, in this society, when you know, how many of you watch the Golden Globes or the Oscars or any of those? The people that get the really great prizes and wear the really great dresses and have the limousines and that you hear about all the time are the actors. You know, best actress, best actor, that kind of thing. The best writer is kind of buried in the fine print. You know, who wrote the screenplay, who wrote the best adapted screenplay. But every single film that you see, of course, starts with one thing, and that's the word. And so now I'm studying screenwriting and working with a gentleman who is a director and screenwriter and producer. He does a lot of television work. Some of the shows that he's done have been CSI shows and a show called The Medium, or Medium, and Sopranos. And he and I are working together to adapt my first book into a screenplay. Because that is another way that I can tell a story, again, using words, but also using pictures, and have a larger audience for the work that I want to do. So everything begins with the word. Even commercials begin with the word, and I know I'm digressing a little bit, but I was listening to the news, and I don't know who it is, but someone has got a contest out there for the Super Bowl where you can just email them or text message them or something and compete to prepare a commercial for the Super Bowl. And I think that's fascinating because that allows everyone to participate in the process. And even commercials, of course, start with the written word. I'm going to do a reading from the book that I just brought out in July of last year. And it's called Girls Most Likely. Girls is a book that is the story of four girls and their friendship from age 10 through their 30th high school reunion. And it follows the way they were friends and not friends and really best friends, and then the friendship fell away. Each one of them has a section in her own voice. Audrey is the corporate queen. She's a corporate executive. She's very organized. She's a workaholic, perhaps maybe too much of a workaholic. And she's also a perfectionist. And if you know anything about perfectionists, Perfectionism is a problem because the finish line keeps moving. It never stays still, and nothing is ever good enough, and that's Audrey's problem. Vaughn is the artsy-fartsy type. She is a college professor and a writer, and she likes to study different religious philosophies and styles of dress. So at any given time, she might be wearing a kimono with dreadlocks or something. She just, you know, she experiments a lot. And she is also the chronicler of the adventures of the girls. So many of the stories are told in Vaughn's voice. Irene is the femme fatale. She is the glamour girl, and she is also a tough little cookie. She is petite and gorgeous and has perfect hair, perfect nails, but she was the only girl raised in a household of boys, so she can throw a baseball pretty well, she can run, and she can fight. So looks are deceiving. And then the fourth girl is Susan, and Susan is an anchor woman. She has a lovely speaking voice and a lovely singing voice, and she's very sophisticated and very determined, and in many ways rather damaged. She was raised by her mother, who was a fabulous woman, but who struggled with alcoholism through most of Sue's life. So Sue has some issues that she needs to overcome as she finds some level of peace and acceptance in her life. The section that I'm going to read from is set when the girls are in elementary school in November of 1963. And this was a pivotal time for our country because it represented the point when President Kennedy was assassinated, which was a very, very difficult time for the country. People just were stunned and were numb and stayed by their television sets that entire weekend, beginning November 22nd. And this section talks about the classroom that the girls are in and what goes on when the assassination is announced. And the kids are in the fifth grade. So what you'll be hearing is Vaughn's voice, and she is describing her fifth grade classroom and how everyone reacted to this very distressing news. At 11 years old, in November 1963, life was good if you wore the right pair of kids. I didn't. Could jump rope without tripping. I couldn't. Or hung with the in crowd. I did. One out of three wasn't bad. We didn't know it then, but the times were changing fast. And even at 10 and 11 years old, we were about to be caught up in the earthquakes of our world, and nothing would ever seem the same again. Mrs. Ailes' fifth grade class had just finished bathroom break. It was Friday, art day, and our desks were being cleared for artistic ventures that were sure to result in water, paint, or clay all over the floor and all over my clothes. Mrs. Ailes clapped her hands from the front of the class. Class, let's get quiet now. Her eagle eyes spotted Billy Porter, headed toward the coat room. Billy, it isn't time for that. Come out of here this minute. Paul, go to the sink and wash your hands, please, she ordered. Why? Paul asked impertinently and bravely. In those days, adults did not reason with children or worry about stifling their independence. They gave orders, and you did as you were told. Mrs. Ailes gave him a look that could uncurl his hair and said, because you were picking your nose, now go wash your hands and then go sit in the chair in the corner. The entire class broke up, giggling and hooting. Paul was embarrassed. He picks his nose so often that I think he'd forgotten he was in a room of people. Yes, I know this is nasty, but it was fifth grade. Now, class, we're going to work on our watercolors again. We have about an hour. Get your cover-ups out and make sure your desks are clear. The anticipation of an afternoon away from fractions and long division was enough to make me want to jump out of my seat. I cleared my desk, and my dad's shirt was already buttoned halfway down when I noticed Mrs. Ailes standing in the door of room 10 chatting with Mrs. Webb. They were talking in very low voices, which wasn't unusual. But the principal had tissues in her hand, and her eyes were wet. Now, that was unusual. Mrs. Webb was the most composed, poised, and perfect woman you could imagine. Nothing ruffled her feathers, no matter how hilarious, no matter how sad. If she was crying, then something was really wrong. And when Mrs. Ailes turned to the class, she was dabbing her eyes with a handkerchief, too. Boys and girls, let me have your attention, please. I want you all to take your seats now, quickly. This is very important. Mr. Walker will set up the audiovisual system. Something has happened. The huge black and white TV hummed until it warmed up, and then Mr. Walker spent what seemed like an hour moving the rabbit ear antenna this way and that until the picture cleared into fuzzy but recognizable images of black, dark grays, and light grays. Girls and boys, listen very carefully. Boyd, sit down, please. This is a very important moment. Our president, President Kennedy, has been shot. It was the first time in my life that I could equate an actual sound to the word gas. 25, 10, and 11-year-olds and three adults inhaled collectively and expelled the air in an uneasy chorus. We turned to one another and whispered the once familiar word as if the pronunciation had been changed overnight by Webster's. Shot. Cowboys and gangsters were shot in black and white movies. Frankenstein was shot. The werewolf, too, with a silver bullet. Robot aliens were shot with ray guns in sci-fi movies, and my dad and grandfather went hunting every year in late November and shot deer. But presidents weren't shot. Not since McKinley, anyway. Especially not this president. We passed messages to one another back and forth down the rows of honey-colored wood desks. We traded notes and watched the blurry images on the screen of the black and white TV as Mr. Walker tried to steady the picture, as if by making the transmitted image crisp and perfect, he could change the reality that it depicted. The sound of static filled our ears. The intermittent snow on the screen transfixed us. As the lumpy shapes solidified into recognizable letters and people, we stopped chatting and held our breaths. Perhaps this horrible thing hadn't really happened. Maybe it was a mistake. I wasn't paying attention to time, but during what would have been our art period, Walter Cronkite's face appeared on screen again. Someone handed him a piece of paper that he read for what seemed to be a long time. Then he looked up with a sad face that reminded me of Uncle Franklin's basset hound. From Dallas, Texas, The Flash, apparently official. President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. We were still holding our breaths. Some 38 minutes ago, there was nothing else he could say. Like us, he was without words, too sad to go on. He made a face and took off his glasses. The broadcast continued, but I don't remember anything else about it. Mr. Walker bowed his head and closed his eyes for a moment. Mrs. Webb paused for a moment in our doorway, tears streaming down her face. Mrs. Ailes' flower-trimmed handkerchief was soaked. Still on camera, Mr. Cronkite wiped his eyes. And for the first and last time in the tenure of Room 10, 5th grade, Gateway Elementary School, Mrs. Ailes' 25 students sat perfectly still, perfectly quiet, wondering how such a thing could happen in their world and what could happen next. Now, that event for your generation is not the pivotal one. I think perhaps the one that would define that sense of shock and dismay might be September 11, 2001, which, you know, seems to be a time when, you know, everything is going on and then there's a sharp turn. For us in 1963, that was another kick in the stomach kind of moment, because you're jarred out of what you thought was a reasonably quiet and, if there is such a thing, normal existence. And for these characters, of course, that moment and then the years to follow, which were other assassinations of political figures and the escalation of the Vietnam War, were pivotal events in and informed their sensibilities as they grew up. Now that's the serious side of one of the serious sides of the lives of these characters. I also wanted to pursue the lighter side. And as much as anyone, I like literature, I like books that are serious and inform me and inspire me and educate me, but I also like to laugh. And I recognize that life is not all tears. Sometimes it seems like it is, but it's also laughter, and I kind of like to mix it up a little bit. So the other section that I'd like to read for you is a depiction of the baptism of two of the characters in the Baptist church. And the characters that I'll be reading about are Vaughn and Irene. And they attend church. They're about 13, and they usually like to sit in the back of the church because that way they can eat candy and pass notes and look at the cute boys who are sitting back there and do a lot of other things that they're really not supposed to be doing in church. And one of the things that they like to do is pass notes. And one of the characters, Irene, decides that she's really interested in one of the boys, and she's going to get his attention by writing him a note. She balls it up, and she's going to throw it, you know, at him so that it just kind of taps him on the shoulder, and he picks it up and reads it. But the note goes astray, and because of that, the girls get into a situation that they had not planned on. Rini will be my soulmate forever for one very special reason. We were baptized together at Second Baptist Church. You don't forget the people who were dunked with you in the baptismal pool, ever. Church attendance was part of our lives then. It wasn't bragged about piously, and there weren't any sanctimonious pronouncements about personal relationships with Jesus or being saved. It was just what people did. As normal as my dad going to work on Monday and mom checking in on grandma on Tuesday afternoons. On Saturday nights, my sisters and I got our hair done, took our baths, and laid out our Sunday school clothes, making sure the patent leather shoes were polished to a blinding shine. On Sunday, it was breakfast, Sunday school at 9:30, church at 11, and don't be late. Now that we were teenagers, Mom and Dad allowed Patty and me to sit separately from them as long as we behaved ourselves. Patty did behave. I didn't. On the second and fourth Sundays, Rini and I sat with the junior choir, passed notes, and whispered until it was time for us to sing. On the first and third Sundays, we ran to the corner store after Sunday school, hung out with friends, kids from Centenary, Love Zion, and St. Paul's, who were also supposed to be in church and weren't, bought hard candy and gum, and slipped back into church in time for the sermon, the passing of the collection plate, and on first Sundays, communion. The only reason we didn't get into real trouble was because our parents sat in the front of the huge sanctuary and we sat in the back. This strategy worked for a while. One Sunday when we were 13, it broke down completely. It was the third Sunday, one of the Sundays when we sat in the back, sucked on hard candy, wrote notes and to each other and any cute boys sitting in the vicinity, and caught up on the gossip that might have occurred since we talked on the phone like the night before. There was usually enough candy, cute boys, and gossip to take up the entire hour and a half service. This Sunday, however, we had an added bonus. L. Davis and his cousin sat three rows ahead. L. was, hands down, the cutest boy in the Second Baptist Church Sunday School program. He was sitting within striking distance of our famous rolled-up notebook paper fastballs and within the crosshairs of Cupid's bow. Rini had decided that he should be her next boyfriend. I had thought about asking him myself, but once I learned Rini was interested, I let that dream go. No way would he have chosen me over her. On her behalf, I scribbled down a few sentences to let him know that someone thought he was really cute. Not just cute, Rini whispered. Think of another word besides cute. As we tried to think of just the right word, Rini forgot and cracked her gum. Ooh, sorry. The sound reverberated in the quiet room, bouncing off the stained glass windows dedicated to the memory of parishioners who died in the 16th century or something, and hit the ears of Rini's Aunt Edith, who turned around to look at us. She was not happy. We studied page 498 of the hymnal to avoid her gaze. Aunt Edith sat in the same pew every Sunday and wore the largest hats you can imagine. She had more hats than my grandmother, if such a thing was possible. Edith Keller had red hats, blue hats, green hats, and purple hats. She took her religion seriously, saying amen very loudly when something Reverend Tharp said agreed with her, and, well, equally loudly when it did not. She sang the hymns with a lot of enthusiasm and volume, but without any talent. All Rini and I needed to do was catch a few bars of Aunt Edith wailing, "Onward Christian Soldiers," at the top of her lungs, and we would dissolve into uncontrollable laughter. This Sunday, Aunt Edith's daffodil-hued confection tilted our way, and we caught a glimpse of a disapproving eye,
before we concentrated on the lyrics to There's a Bomb in Gilead. I finished the note, signed Renee's name, and passed it to her for delivery. Renee Keller made good use of her position as the only girl in a family of boys. She could curse like a sailor, run like the wind, and throw a curveball when she needed to. The note was balled up into the proper shape, readied for its pitch. She molded it in her hand, swayed a little from side to side, just like the players in the World Series on TV, and let it rip. It ripped right onto Aunt Edith's daffodil hat. "Oops," Renee said. We started to duck, but before we did, Aunt Edith turned around, saw us sitting there with expressions of near panic and hysterical rapture, also known as hysterical laughter, and called out to Reverend Thorpe, gesturing back to us. "These girls want to be baptized, Reverend, back here, see?" "Oh no," I started to say, shaking my head. Renee nudged me in the ribs. I closed my mouth. There was no way to back out. The eyes of 350 people, including both of our mothers, my father, my sisters, two of Renee's brothers, and my grandmother, were on us. Reverend Tharp beamed. "How wonderful! Two young people, young ladies, come forward!" "Renee," I hissed through clenched teeth, "what have you gotten me into?" Don't get me wrong. It wasn't that I intended to remain an unbaptized heathen all my life. You don't go to the Baptist church without an intention to be baptized someday. But I was 13, preoccupied with school, boys, music lessons, boys, hair, makeup, and boys. Getting baptized was on one of my to-do lists, just not the one that I expected to get to in the next 20 years. So here I was, standing in front of the entire congregation, the living embodiment of Christian commitment. I was scared to death. "Why didn't you tell us you were going to join the church?" Mom said, as if I'd forgotten to mention that my head had fallen off. "I'd have told your grandfather to come. He'd want to be here." Patty thought it was funny. Jeannie didn't understand. So Mom and Dad spent the rest of the drive home explaining. I, of course, should have been listening, but as usual, I wasn't. I wondered just what Renee and her Aunt Edith had gotten me into, especially when I heard Daddy say, "You know what the problem is with Baptists, don't you? They don't hold them under the water long enough." If it hadn't been part of the normal ritual in a Baptist church, our baptismal experience would have qualified for a National Geographic special. It had all the right elements: virgins, water, ritualistic language, loud singing, and white robes. We were dressed by the senior members of the Circle of Ruth Society, women who were old enough to have known the biblical Ruth personally. They fussed over us like mother hens, clicking their tongues and patting our cheeks, saying, "Bless your hearts!" The baptismal robes were white choir robes drafted for use in the festivity, and they were four sizes too big for Renee and me, so safety pins were used to keep them from flapping around us. Nothing could be done about the length, however, so Renee and I held the robes away from our bare feet as we made our way through the corridors behind the pulpit and loft to the main sanctuary. The back corridors of Second Baptist were cool, quiet, and dark. They reminded me of the descriptions of the catacombs beneath Rome and had the same kind of mysterious aura. I shivered with fear. Baptism was part of the tradition of symbolic rebirth. At least that's what our Sunday school teacher had told us. So why did I feel as if I was going to an execution? "Vaughn!" Renee's loud whisper penetrated the spooky darkness. "What?" I shouted back. My voice was shrill with fear. "Don't forget to take a..." "No talking, girls," came the stern voice of a sister of Ruth. "Quiet now." "But I need to tell her." Renee sounded desperate. "What was wrong?" "Did you hear what I said?" The peach and pecan-shaped vowels did not soften the sharpness of the voice. "Yes, ma'am," we murmured back. I wondered what it was that Renee was trying to tell me. We continued down the shadow corridor in silence. When we emerged from the bowels of the church into the light of the sanctuary, we were like bats flying into the morning. My glasses were safely tucked away in Sister Ogletree's purse. I couldn't see anything, and I blinked furiously to focus. Even Renee was dazzled for a few seconds. That was not helpful. If Renee, who feared nothing, was scared to death, I should be petrified. I started to shake uncontrollably. Reverend Tharp's face loomed before me. I jumped. He placed a reassuring hand on my shoulder and smiled. When my eyes focused, I noticed that he was wearing a black robe and boots. I should have known then. He began to speak, and the organ played softly in the background. I didn't hear a word he said because my heart was pounding like the telltale heart, and I was standing on a ledge in front of a pool of water that looked to be hundreds of feet deep. I panicked. When did Second Baptist have a swimming pool installed? I had stood on this very place a million times for the Easter program, and I'd never seen a deep pool of water here. Was he going to push me in? Drop me in? Throw me in? The minister smiled down at me and patted me on the shoulder. I took a deep breath. What's the matter with you? My conscience chided me. This is Reverend Thorpe, for God's sake. He's your grandfather's friend. He's not going to murder you in front of all these people. Vaughn, you're so stupid sometimes. Of course I was. What was I thinking? This man was scholarly, genteel, and stately. Despite the singing and the swelling chords of the pipe organ, I thought I heard Renee's voice. I turned around and saw her mouth moving and her hands waving in the air. Again, she was trying to tell me something. She looked even more frightened. I tried to lip read like we did in class when we ran out of scrap paper for passing notes. Vaughn, take a dip. Take a dip? Reverend Tharp touched me on the shoulder. I looked up at him and he gestured toward the water. He took my elbow and helped me step onto the first ledge where the water wrapped itself around my ankles. He smiled benevolently at me. It was then that genteel, stately Reverend Thorpe grabbed me around the shoulders, pushed me backwards into the coldest water I've ever felt in my life, and tried to drown me. I fought him off the best I could, flailing my arms and kicking, just like the swim teacher taught us at the Y, but I was no match for him. He held me down for at least a half an hour before releasing me and bringing me to a standing position. I hadn't taken a breath, so I was spitting, gasping, and snorting in an attempt to breathe. Water poured out of my nose and mouth, and I was nearly blind. I stumbled and almost fell, trying to escape from my assailant, who uttered the triumphant words of my rebirth and led me to the other side of the pool to be greeted by a sister of Ruth and a warm towel. I felt as if I had been born again after escaping the attentions of a serial killer. The organ music swelled around the huge sanctuary as the choirs proclaimed our rebirth in beautifully coordinated tones of alto and mezzo-soprano and majestic bass. Renee and I sat in the chairs of honor, wrapped in towels looking like drowned rats, according to my sister Patty, and shivering as if we'd been refrigerated for an hour. We didn't dare look at each other. The piety of the event dictated somber expressions and regal demeanor. But seriousness can be overdone. I sneaked a glance at Renee, who had chosen the same moment to sneak a glance at me. Her dark eyes danced with laughter. Vaughn, what I said was, take a deep breath. We dissolved into giggles and tears. The proud sisters of Ruth told our parents that the spirit had overwhelmed us, but somehow I think my parents knew better. I thank you all for listening to me and for coming out. If you have any questions about writing or the books that you like to read or the text messages that you like to send, if they're not too personal or anything else, I'd love to hear from you. And if you ever want to email me, I do have a website, and you can email me at Sheila, and that's S-H-E-I-L-A, at SheilaJWilliams.com. Thank you very much.
Do any of you have questions now? We have microphone? Question? I know one thing I like to hear is how you get your ideas. I read something about structure and imagination. You said three-fourths of writing was imagination, but obviously your characters come some from your life, but where do you get your ideas for writing?
Did everyone hear the question? Okay. I get my ideas from writing everywhere. And while none of my books are autobiographical, I do obviously draw upon my life's experience in the years that I've been alive. But things just pop up in the news, something someone will say to you, an article that I'll read, something you see on television. there's so much going on in the real world that you can't, things that happen in the real world are so amazing, you can't make them up. If I tried to put them in a book, no one would believe it. My second book is called The Shade of My Own Tree, and as Connie mentioned before, it's the story of a woman who leaves an abusive marriage after many years. And I wrote that book in response to a really ugly situation that took place in broad daylight on 4th Street in downtown Cincinnati, Ohio. A young woman, mother of three, she's studying to be a paralegal, working in a law office, and her former husband basically tracked her down and murdered her right on the street there. And just before that event took place, a similar event took place in Columbus, Ohio, where I'm from, where, again, a young woman was murdered. And her two children, and her, she was murdered, her husband, then her former husband, then killed himself, and her, obviously her children are now orphaned. And it was just such an ugly thing, and it reminded me again that this issue of violence in the home is something that has not gone away, and we need to talk about it again, and we need to remind people that you know, this does not need to happen, and it affects all of us. And so I wrote The Shade of My Own Tree, which is the story of a woman who is in a marriage like this, but after 20 years decides she has had enough and she leaves. And that book I almost did not even send to my editor because I thought the story was way too intense and I didn't think anybody would want to read it. And I didn't think anybody cared, frankly. I didn't think anybody cared. And I sent it in anyway because I was on a deadline and had to get there. So I did send it. And my editor liked it, which surprised me because I was prepared to write something else. But what really got to me was that when the book came out, I heard from people all over, basically all over the world, from as far away as Washington State. I'm doing a book club in near Puget Sound in 2 months on that book, by the way. I heard from someone in Queensland, Australia. I heard from one of the guys who works on my website was doing some work on my website, and I called him because I hadn't gotten his bill, and I said, "You're going to send me the bill?" And he said, "No." He said, I'm going to do this work for you, you know, this particular project for you. I'm not going to charge you for it." He said, "Because I was the son of a mother who was beaten like that, and I was only 5 or 6 years old, and I couldn't do anything, and I felt bad about that all my life. And this is my way of paying her, you know, paying back, or paying forward, I guess." I heard from the father of a young girl who had this experience. I heard from people in all walks of life, the husbands, the sons, the fathers, the brothers, the mothers, everyone, the children of women who had been through this. And so I realized that this book had some importance and some relevance. And that's an example where I got the idea basically from a horrible incident. And I decided to write about Opal in Shade of My Own Tree because I wanted to show that women do survive, families do survive, and there is a way to get out. And lastly, not to go on too much about this, but when Shade came out, I got a phone call from a girl I'd gone to high school with. And now, you know, high school for me is 30 years in the past, but I heard from her and she said, I bought 4 copies of your book. You did not know this. No one knew this, she said, but I was in a marriage like that. And she said, one day I just decided I had had enough, and she had a newborn baby, a like 4 or 5 week old baby, and she basically just packed up the diaper bag and her purse and left with that newborn baby. And she's doing fine now, but it just reminded me of how art imitates life and life imitates art, and the two are really balled up very closely together. So I get my ideas from all kinds of places. Sometimes I'll see a person waiting on a bus or whatever and begin to form a story about that person just based on the way they're standing, or on the way their baseball cap is on their head, or whatever it is. Something will trigger an idea, and that idea begins to spin, and then I begin to spin a character study and a storyline, and it goes from there.
Do any of you have questions? Well, if you want to chat with her afterwards, maybe in a less formal setting, she'll be around. And yes. Thank you again very, very much.
Thank you.
If you want to purchase a book, I guess you might sit over there a few minutes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely.
But, okay. I had one other question, and you all don't have to stay, but if you have a few minutes. Also, when you did On the Right Side of a Dream, you did research about cooking and culinary arts. You seem to do research to know your subjects.
Right.
Is that a big part of it, an essential part of it?
It can be. My third book, On the Right Side of a Dream, took one of my characters back to school. And she was a woman who wasn't the kind of person who would go back to school, and it really terrified her. But she decided, she loves to cook, and she decided that in order to take her cooking to the next level and really be professional, she needed to attend a culinary institute. And so she applied and attended. And of course, since she went to school, I had to know a little bit about what she was going to go through in order to write the story. And I contacted the Midwest Culinary Institute in Cincinnati, and they said, come on down. So I spent 6 weeks hanging out with two classes of folks, one in the pastry chef division and one in the general cooking division. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with the curriculum in those kinds of schools, or if you have friends who are chefs or sous chefs or anything, line chefs, but that is some hard work. Those folks are on their feet all day, and they're picking up, you know, casseroles that are like this, and making dishes that, you know, you and I will go to a restaurant and we take them for granted. It was just an amazing experience to see how the kitchens were organized. One of the head chefs that ran the program is former military in the British Army, and he organizes his classroom along the same lines as not a battalion, but one of the divisions in the Army. And so they have clean up a certain way, and they put everything away a certain way, and they cook a certain way, and they're organized in teams. And it was just incredible to watch the level of discipline, the level of hard work. The people who cook for you, who cook for you at Applebee's or wherever you like to go, believe me, that is some hard work. And also the creativity, because not only is it it's work putting the food together, but there's an element of creativity as well. And I watched some of these folks put together beautiful hors d'oeuvres. And then on the pastry chef side, they did amazing cakes and pies and tarts and things you just can't imagine can be done with chocolate if you're a chocoholic like I am. So it was a lot of fun, and I was supposed to be there 4 weeks, but every week they would have another class that was just so interesting. And so it got to the point where I was there 6 weeks, but I hadn't written the chapters I was supposed to write about the cooking. And my husband finally said, okay, you're going to have to stop going to the cooking school, having a good time, and come home and actually, you know, put your butt in the chair and write the book, which is, of course, what I had to do. But I have a great appreciation for all the chefs of the world, because Food Channel notwithstanding, it is a very difficult profession and takes a lot of work, a lot of discipline, and a lot of creativity. But I had a good time, and I gained a little weight when I spent the summer there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's all.
I could ask questions for you. Fascinated by the book.
Jack Montgomery. Oh! I was hoping you said he was going to come. Oh, what? South Carolina Jack Montgomery.
And if you were not raised so to them, you were watching very closely.
I was raised exactly.
My grandfather was Taped, huh? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Click.